The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Okay, we are here today in the case of Grant versus Leonhardt, and we are here today on a motion to dismiss, and I would like the moving party to present the argument.
May it please the court. My name is Paul Figley. I represent defendant Jan Leonhardt. The issue before the court is fairly simple. The question is whether a young lady that owns a small nine-hole country club can be held liable for the negligent act of one of her patrons. It's a simple question and something that the Ohio legislature has addressed. It enacted the Ohio Dram Shop Act, which clearly states that under only very limited circumstances can a liquor license holder be held liable for the negligent acts of one of the patrons. And that liability can arise only when two conditions are met. First, the permit holder or an employee of the permit holder knowingly sold an intoxicating beverage to at least one of the following, and here only one applies, and that is a noticeably intoxicated person. A second and completely independent bar would arise if the person's intoxication did not proximately cause the personal injury or property damage. The Ohio Supreme Court has made absolutely clear that when we are addressing the knowingly sold to a noticeably intoxicated person, the issue is actual knowledge. So if the bartender doesn't know actually that this person is noticeably intoxicated, then there can be no liability. It's not something.
Counsel, how do you determine whether someone has actual knowledge? Is there a situation where somebody sits down at a bar and says, "I'm really drunk"?
Well, the Ohio courts have addressed six different ways in which you might find that actual knowledge. And one of them is if the person comes in and says, "I'm really drunk." A second one would be if the server had served so many drinks to the person that they would know that the person must be drunk. The other four pertain to the appearance of the person. If the server looks at the patron and sees that he or she is obviously drunk, then the server would know that the person's obviously drunk. Second, if the server knows the patron personally and observes unusual behavior that would not happen if the person were sober, then the server would know that the person's obviously drunk. The server might also know if the server was told, or if we found out later, that the person had consumed a great deal of alcohol before reaching the server, so that if you'd had 15 beers at another establishment, came into the bar, anyone would know that 15 beers in a short amount of time would probably...
Counsel, isn't that going more towards constructive knowledge? You said that we're talking about actual knowledge.
It is actual knowledge, but the way the courts reason is that if you observe the person, you can tell. And any trained bartender should be able to observe that a person who's drunk 15 beers shortly before arriving would be intoxicated. The final way is by doing some sort of an algebraic calculation using a blood alcohol content.
And is that something the bartender is expected to have this knowledge of algebra?
No, it works the same way. It works the same way as with the knowledge that somebody had a lot of alcohol before they arrived. Okay. The trained bartender should be able to know that someone who has a very high blood alcohol content would be drunk, and just from their appearance and their behavior. In this case, none of those six ways apply. Here, the servers did not have personal knowledge of how much Mr. Benton had consumed. Mr. Benton did not come forward and say that he was noticeably intoxicated. In fact, he probably didn't think he was. Looking to the different ways of observing it, in this instance, there's no allegations that the servers observed anything prior to sale that would have suggested that he was noticeably intoxicated. Neither of the servers personally knew Mr. Benton, so they weren't able to assess his behavior against the way that he would normally behave if he was sober. There is no direct evidence that Benton consumed a great deal of alcohol before he was served his last drink.
But don't we have the situation here where we're talking about a high BAC after the fact, and going towards your algebraic formula, given the fact that this man's BAC was so high at the time it was tested at the hospital, at the urgent care center, doesn't it seem to make sense that he would have been appearing in some sort of noticeable intoxicated way at the bar?
Well, I don't think that follows at all, Your Honor. First, to do that calculation, you need to have, let's take a look at the one time where we know what happened. And that was in the Morrison versus Fletch case. And there was a blood alcohol of 0.120 at 8 o'clock p.m. And the assumption was made that the person had had two beers after leaving the bar. And he left the bar at about 2 or 2:30. And from that, an expert was able to calculate what the blood alcohol level would have been when he left the bar at 2:30. That has really very few variables in it. Because what he drank after leaving the bar was two beers, we have a precise knowledge of how much volume he consumed and what the alcohol content, the percentage of alcohol, was in that volume. Okay. In this case, we don't have anywhere near as good a timeline. We know that at some time after 6:30, Mr. Benton had his blood alcohol content taken, but we don't know exactly when that was. We do know that he had his last drink at the bar at around 5 o'clock. But we do not know how much alcohol he consumed after he left the country club. We don't know that for a couple of reasons. First, he didn't have two beers after he left. At his cousin's house, he had two gin and tonics, which he fixed himself. And we don't know the size of the gin and tonics, nor do we know how much was gin and how much was tonic.
But, counsel, doesn't that go to the entire – you're here saying that we need to dismiss at this stage without allowing it to go on to
yes.
trial. Don't these factual uncertainties warrant development at trial, and perhaps an expert witness who could try to construct this timeline to give the court the knowledge that it needs in order to make a determination whether there actually was actual knowledge?
I think that if we had the limited specific facts that they had in Fletch versus Morrison, that might be appropriate. Here we don't, because here we don't know how much he consumed at his cousin's house with the gin and tonics. We don't have a precise time of when the blood alcohol content was taken. And we have another source of alcohol that was probably involved. Mr. Benton had a flask with him. And it's possible that some expert could surmise as to how much he drank from the flask and when he drank it, but there's nothing here to indicate it. And I might go on to point out, Your Honor, that in plaintiff's allegations, there's no specific allegation that this kind of a calculation is possible, or any indication that there's an expert that could undertake to do it. Frankly, we don't see how anyone could, in good conscience, try to come up with a specific number when we have so many variables, because there's simply no way of ever finding out how large the gin and tonics were, nor how strong they were. Moreover, we do have the problem of the flask, which Mr. Benton carried with him. So for that reason, this is one of those cases where the statute was enacted to protect people in the circumstance of Ms. Leonard, and this is a specific ground which plaintiffs cannot meet.
But it also, the statute was not enacted in order to have such narrow focus, in that only when you have such a defined timeline as there was in the Morrison versus Flett case, that that's the only time that we can find actual knowledge.
It's not just the timeline. If it was just the timeline, I think you'd have a very good point. But it's also that we don't know the amount of alcohol that he drank or when he drank it. And that skews any possibility of doing a precise and credible calculation.
But isn't that the point of the discovery process?
If there was any expectation that they could come up with specific information to provide to their expert, perhaps. But there's no assertion in the allegations that such a calculation has been made or could be made.
Okay, can we move on to the proximate cause issue?
Yes, Your Honor. The Dram Shop Act has as one of its provisions that the plaintiff must show that the injury was proximately caused by the service of alcohol to the noticeably intoxicated person. Proximate cause is a major part of American tort law. What it does is limit the liability of people when there is cause in fact. Here, Ms. Leonhardt is liable only for the injuries which are proximately caused by the service of alcohol to a noticeably intoxicated patron. There are a number of obvious circumstances where there might be cause in fact, but the courts would not find proximate cause. For example, if a noticeably intoxicated patron was sold a six-pack of Coors beer in bottles, and 2 weeks later throws those bottles out of an apartment window, and they shatter and cause people to lose their tires. Well, there's direct causation. If Ms. Leonhardt's people hadn't sold the six-pack when it's in the bottles? I don't know.
I'll take judicial notice.
If it hadn't been sold, the injury wouldn't have taken place. But the courts would not find that there was proximate cause. Another example would be if someone, even at the wedding reception, drank too much, went home and sold her mother-in-law's wheelbarrow for $2. There would be a conversion. She would have stolen, in effect, her mother-in-law's wheelbarrow and gotten very little for it.
So, counsel, is that what we have in this situation?
No, that's not.
Are you going to make it?
That's not. But we can imagine worse examples. For example, if someone was at Ms. Leonhardt's country club and got drunk and driving home, crashed into a telephone pole with a TV camera on it for security, and bad people noticed that the security camera was down and burgled somebody's store, the courts would not find proximate cause. Moreover, if a patron were driving home after drinking too much at Ms. Leonhardt's country club and rear-ended a surgeon, and as a consequence, the surgeon was unable to make it on time to a life or death operation, and someone died. There again, Ohio courts would not find proximate cause. And the Ohio Supreme Court spoke to this issue in the Gressman case. It explained that the reason why the Ohio legislature had enacted this statute was because people who drink too much in bars often go out to the parking lot, get in their cars, and have accidents on the way home. Now, certainly there are other kinds of horrible things they could do that would fall within the proximate cause standard, but that's really what the legislature had in mind. That's what is reasonably foreseeable, and reasonably foreseeable is the standard for determining proximate cause. And here,
One make an analogy that an automobile is a vehicle in the same way that a jet ski perhaps is a vehicle?
Perhaps. But all of the cases that have been cited involve accidents on the roads. And here, it's not like he drove the jet ski to the wedding and then drove the jet ski home.
Well, that possibly could be because Ohio is not a lot of water.
There's an odd set of circumstances here that made this happen. First, he was staying at his cousin's cottage, which was within walking distance of the country club, and he walked back to the cottage, something that would obviously not involve any liability. When he got there, he asked about the jet ski, and his cousin, who was better instincts kicked in, was of the view that he shouldn't take it, but she was too sick to get out of bed and contest the point. And then he took it out at dusk. These circumstances, we submit, are not the kind of reasonably foreseeable circumstances that can meet the proximate cause test that is an essential requirement for the statute to allow liability. The starting point is there is no liability. It's for plaintiffs to prove or to come up with allegations that squarely and fairly would meet both the noticeably sold to a knowingly sold to a noticeably intoxicated person and the proximate cause.
So you're not arguing a superseding event here. You're simply saying
that. No, Your Honor, if it was a superseding event, that is something that would clearly go to a jury.
Okay.
But if the basic allegations don't meet the foreseeability standard approximate cause, then the proximate cause element is not met. And that's certainly not a question for the jury.
Okay.
So for these reasons, we respectfully submit that the motion to dismiss should be granted.
Thank you, counsel.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Elizabeth Keith, and I represent Leslie Grant, the plaintiff in this matter. Your Honor, the plaintiff opposes defendant's motion to dismiss on the simple grounds that the motion is procedurally premature. The Court is well aware of the standard for granting a motion to dismiss, that is, taking all the allegations in the complaint as true, that plaintiff has failed to state a cause of action and cannot prove any set of facts that would entitle the plaintiff to relief. The cases governing this issue under Ohio law overwhelmingly indicate that in cases of premises liability for the actions of an intoxicated person, the court should not take the case away from the jury where questions of fact exist. Thus, the plaintiff respectfully requests that this court deny defendant's motion to dismiss and allow the case to proceed forward with discovery, as Your Honor mentioned, and litigation. Your Honor, I believe that there are several elements that make the statute applicable to the case that are not in dispute and that were not disputed by counsel. Therefore, my focus is going to be on the two elements of knowingly sold an intoxicating beverage to a noticeably intoxicated person and proximate cause.
Counsel, I'd like to see what actual knowledge. If we had no observations that these bartenders really didn't see anything unusual until after they sold the last drink, how do we find actual knowledge in this case?
Your Honor, that's a good question. And I think my opposing counsel has narrowed that down too restrictively, as Your Honor, I believe, mentioned as well. What we know from Gressman is that actual knowledge is required. What is also required in Gressman is that a person may obtain knowledge from an existing condition when his relation to it, his association with it, his control over it, or his direction of it are such as to give him actual personal information concerning it. What opposing counsel is trying to do is to convince this court that the only way the defendant could have had actual knowledge is by a personal witnessing of observable behaviors. And that is not that's not what's required by Gressman. In fact, the policy of the statute, which we have, as Your Honor noted, the policy is also to allow injured parties to recover. It's not only to protect the dram shops from liability, but the policy behind the statute is to force permit holders and their employees to be more responsible for their actions. The policy does not require that the bartender personally witness the intoxicated person, only that the intoxicated person's conduct be noticeable. That is required by the statute. As counsel mentioned, there are many different ways that we can obtain this knowledge. What is present in this particular case is knowledge through extrinsic evidence, and that is what, in fact, is pled in the complaint. As opposing counsel noted, we did not allege any facts as to an expert witness. I would like to represent to the court that we are in the process of retaining an expert witness and do intend to do the algebraic formula to determine what the standards of intoxication would have been during the time of the wedding reception on August 2nd. However, what we did allege in the complaint is the evidence that we have from a guest at the reception. The guest was just a casual observer, not a trained bartender, but someone who noticed during a very brief encounter with Mr. Benton that Mr. Benton smelled of alcohol.
Counsel, that sounds like it's going to constructive knowledge. A casual observer saw something, and so therefore the bartender should have known. Isn't that going away from actual knowledge and almost going towards strict liability on a bar?
Your Honor, I don't believe that's the case at all. The case you're referring to is Tillett, where the court clearly said constructive knowledge is not sufficient. The distinction between Tillett and Morrison, for example, is that in Morrison we had extrinsic evidence. We had something else. In Tillett, for example, all that we had was the patron's own admission that he had consumed 15 beers during the course of the day. The live-in girlfriend who lived with him did not observe him to be intoxicated. The bartenders did not observe him to be intoxicated, and the court found constructive knowledge is not sufficient. However, in Morrison, where we have an expert witness who was able to postulate what the behaviors of the intoxicated patron would have been at the bar, was sufficient at least to allow the case to go to a jury. The procedural posture in that case was a motion for summary judgment, which is, of course, further along than we are right now. But what is important is that we look at not only a personal observation, but we look at the circumstances that existed during that time period to determine whether or not the bartenders had knowledge.
And but don't we also look at the level of experience of the bartenders? I think in some of those cases, the bartender's experience was higher than here, where we have two bartenders that have only been working for 9 months. Are they held to the same standard of observing or needing to observe behaviors that somebody who has more experience is held to?
I think the standard should be the same across the board. We can't say that bartenders who have had less than 6 months experience get a free pass, and bartenders who have 6 months or more should be held to a higher standard of liability. That is not present in the statute in any form, and I don't believe it's present in the case law either. The bartenders here had been trained and served as bartenders for almost a year, and I think that is certainly sufficient experience to where they should have known, they should have had the observations that, in fact, this particular guest did during the course of the reception.
Does the number of bartenders come into play? In some cases, there's been discussion of the fact that because there were two bartenders, they collectively were not able to develop the kind of actual knowledge that one bartender might have in the same circumstance.
I think that can play a part in some of the cases, as you mentioned. And, of course, in this case, what we have is both Ann and Fred. We have two different bartenders working the reception that particular day. But I would like to point the court to the case of Harris, where in Harris the court found, actually reversed the defendant's grant of summary judgment on the basis that there was opportunity to observe. There was an opportunity for the defendant nightclub to observe at the point of checking IDs at the door, and also an opportunity to observe through the sale of at least one beer at the bar. And even though those are two distinct, separate employees of the defendant, the court held that was sufficient to at least allow this to go to the jury. Your Honor, and that's what we're here today. The plaintiff can prove the facts that are alleged in the complaint, and in fact the plaintiff has alleged sufficient facts to show that the defendant had knowledge that Mr. Benton was noticeably intoxicated at the time of sale. Moving on to the proximate cause issue, it's interesting, and I'm not exactly sure how to respond to some of the hypotheticals raised by opposing counsel, but what I'd like to do is draw the court's attention to the law, which is why we're here today. The Ohio courts look at proximate cause in two different stages. They look at whether the intoxication proximately caused the plaintiff's injuries, and secondly, they look at whether the permit holder's service of alcohol proximately caused the patron's intoxication. Most importantly, however, the Court of Appeals of Ohio has explained that proximate cause, as used in determining a permit holder's liability, does not have to be the sole cause, does not have to be the sole cause, and is in fact a question for the jury. That is supported.
Counsel, don't we also have the issue of perhaps a superseding event? I mean, could the jury find that? I know that counsel didn't really mention that there was a superseding event, but don't we have the likelihood that there might have been a superseding event here to take it out of proximate cause?
There may be a likelihood. The extent of that likelihood, I'm not prepared to expand upon right now, but at the very least, what Your Honor is pointing out is the fact that this is something that requires this case to go further with litigation, or at least go to a jury, because it's not ripe for dismissal by the court at this time. What opposing counsel does mention is this issue of foreseeability, and as the court aptly noted, the mode of transportation of the intoxicated individual, I think, is really irrelevant. We presume that most people probably drive cars. There was a case also involving a motorcycle. Here, the method of transportation was a jet ski. I don't see that really affects the analysis here. The purpose, of course, of the statute, going back to the policy, is to prevent the intoxicated person from causing injury and then getting away with that. That is exactly what happened here. We have an intoxicated person who left the country club and then caused a subsequent injury. To me, this seems extremely clear. There is no dispute over whether Mr. Benton's intoxication, which was more than double the legal limit in Ohio, caused him to crash into Mr. Grant's fishing boat.
How do you take into consideration the alcohol that was consumed from the flask prior to the reception, or right at the beginning of the reception, mm-hmm. and then the alcohol that was consumed after the reception? How do those affect the analysis here?
They really don't affect the analysis of proximate cause, because the standard in Ohio is simply that the permit holder's service of alcohol to the intoxicated person was a contributing factor to the intoxication, and that is what we have here. Your Honor, I think our expert will be able to postulate that it's simply improbable that defendants Country Club served only two beers, and in fact the bartenders here don't limit it to two beers. What they say is they remember selling at least one beer each. But what is important is that the intoxication is an ongoing process. It's not something that you can easily divide, and I think that's where the courts are going as well in cases such as Morrison, where we have an extremely similar fact pattern. We have an individual who drank at a bar during the day and then left to have two drinks at a friend's house, a social host home, and the court, the lower court granted a motion for summary judgment in favor of the defendant, and the appellate court reversed and said that was inappropriate because, as I just mentioned, as long as the permit holder contributed to the person's intoxication, that is sufficient to bring it to a jury. Your Honor, the plaintiff respectfully requests through counsel that this court deny defendant's motion to dismiss as a premature dismissal of a case that belongs in the hands of the jury. The case law in Ohio clearly supports plaintiff's position and provides mandatory binding authority on this court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Your Honor, if I might make a few brief.
I will allow it, even though you did not ask for it before the argument began.
Thank you, Your Honor. With regard to the knowingly sold to a noticeably intoxicated patron, I thought I was very clear in saying that the very first way is the personal knowledge of the bartender about what the bartender did. And certainly after that we can go to the observation. But none of the cases in Ohio involve or turned upon observations made by someone other than the bartender, with the exception of the one case where the plaintiff observed that the gentleman appeared sober, and that was in the Tillett case. But that kind of observation by someone in a back room or out in the lobby is not something that can amount to actual knowledge of the bartender. Second, I know plaintiff's counsel says there may be an expert in the future, and the expert will certainly do the kind of calculations that would be needed to meet the standards, but none has been brought forward, and our point is none could credibly be brought forward given the very vague information available from which to do the calculation. Because of the unknown quantity and percentage of alcohol in the gin and tonics and the unknown alcohol drunk from the flask, after leaving the wedding reception. There's no credible way to do that kind of a calculation. Finally, on the proximate cause point, if someone had driven a boat home from a bar, certainly counsel's point would be well taken. But this wasn't someone doing that. This was someone who got home safely and then wanted to do something for recreation. If he had used a go-kart or power skateboards, it's the same kind of a thing. He's no longer doing what the statute contemplated and undertook to provide a remedy for. For these reasons, we request that the motion be carried.
Okay, thank you, counsel. I'm going to take a few minutes to deliberate and leave the room.
Judge Pratt deliberates with the life and times and the true story of our friend Jan and Herbert Benson. So Judge Pratt was very kind to create this PowerPoint to entertain you while he deliberates. From a very young age. Eventually, he gave up his personal fondness for alcohol and became a well-known, well-respected bartender. Jan was the inspiration for the Tom Cruise's character in Cocktail, or so he likes to tell all of his friends and himself. Despite his brilliant success, he was tired of being only a bartender, and so he bought a golf course. A small party room, which he calls a reception hall, adjoins the golf course. Jan often rents it out to the As a perfectionist, he always hires only the best bartender. Training his bartenders to refuse service to those who are noticeably intoxicated. And in this case, guest was not intoxicated, and Jan agreed. Brett thought this guy was very intoxicated. Jan all decided this guy was just hanging out in the morning. Because both Jan and Fred did this in high school. Fred decided this man was upset about making a turkey. This wedding ended at 10:30. Anthony was getting so tired. Thank you. Benton right before last call. Benton right after buying his last drink. Lydia really looks like this. She does not see well, and she was there. So then he had the notorious two gin and tonics. Benton fought with Lydia and finally convinced her to let him use his jet ski.
Okay, thank you to Professor Keith and Professor Figley for a superb example of oral advocacy. Again, we do this demonstration argument as both a finale to the fall semester and a preview for the spring semester. So in the spring semester, you yourself will be up at this exact lectern arguing motions in a trial court and in an appellate court. And I failed to mention that in our three-year tradition of doing this, we have a proud two-year tradition of Professor Figley never winning. And so we're very anxious to hear if Professor Figley continues his proud tradition. So let's bring back Judge Spratt to hear the verdict.
My class always does that when I come in, so. Okay, I would like to commend both of the advocates again on doing a very good job. And this is a very close case that we have here. But we must consider the standard in Ohio. A matter should be dismissed for failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted when the plaintiff's complaint or petition cannot establish any grounds for relief or cannot prove any set of facts that could sustain the claim. And really what we have to do here as a court is to review these complaints in almost an academic manner and figure out if there's anything there that could actually support relief for the plaintiff. At this time, where it is premature, and I'm going to deny the motion to dismiss. However, what I will say is, Counselor Figley, you did a very good job, and I've seen you. And I've seen you approach poor Mr. Grant's status, walking in here with your cane year after year, trying and trying and trying to win. Although I am denying the motion to dismiss, I do encourage the parties to attempt to settle this case in some fashion. Counselor Keith, while you also did a very good job, I don't think there are a lot of facts here. The complaint, as opposing counsel said, is very, very thin. We have The statute is based on limited liability, and I think that the statute really did not mean to contemplate these kinds of incidents where someone does get home safely and then decide to jump on a jet ski after that time. I think that the jury, though, needs to hear these questions. I think we need to develop more discovery. There's enough there regarding actual knowledge that could be possibly developed. I'm not confident that it is going to be developed in a way that supports your client, but at this stage, I do think that it is, like you said, procedurally premature. We need time to do discovery, and we need time to develop this case to see if there's anything there. Again, if you can settle, you would save a lot of time and expense for the parties, and they can move on with their lives, given the fact that this complaint is pretty thin at this point. Okay? I would like to open it up for questions for the advocates. Anybody? No questions? All right, happy Thanksgiving.